A Democrat seeks to replace Don Young in the U.S. House. As usual. Will the Democrat lose? As usual. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. To talk with Ethan Berkowitz, Democrat of Anchorage, former House Minority Leader, call now at 1-800-478-8255. Toll free, that's 478-TALK, toll free. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@APRN.org when it gets crowded. Meet Ethan Berkowitz on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
the University of Alaska, the home of award-winning faculty, students, and alumni, and offering 500 different degrees and certificates. Find one that's right and do something major. Information at alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Ethan Berkowitz, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
It's great to be back.
Yeah, I think last time you were a minority leader, and this time you're running against Don Young. We all know that he's somewhat politically crippled, and I think your hopes must be high.
Well, we're feeling good about everything, and we set out running this race, not so much that I'm running against Don Young, but I'm running for the seat, and things are looking very good at this point. Very good.
Well, of course, Alaska only has one seat in the U.S. House. It seems almost certain that the Democrats will remain in charge of the U.S. House, so that would, I would think that would work in your favor.
Well, it seems to. I've had a lot of encouragement from people here who want to make sure that Alaska still has a seat in the majority. They want to make sure that we do have a representative who's able to be effective. And as people keep saying, you're ready to do the job.
Well, should you be elected and go to Washington, what committees are you looking towards?
I think that I'd most like to get on the Energy and Commerce Committee. Energy is at the intersection of all the major issues that the country and the state faces, and it's also the fact that Alaska is an energy state, more than just our oil and gas, but also our renewables, and we ought to be leading the way, and if I get a seat at that table, I can make a big difference right away.
Of course, the Speaker of the House is now Nancy Pelosi. And I don't think she's well regarded in Alaska. What do you say when it's pointed out that you realize, of course, that Nancy Pelosi would be in charge if you elect Ethan Berkowitz?
Well, Nancy Pelosi is the Speaker of the House today, and Don Young's in Congress. So I say that we've got a chance here to be in the majority party and persuade Democrats. We've had years, 36 years of Don Young using his methods to try and be persuasive, and it's time to do something new. We need a different kind of approach in Washington, D.C., one that's less confrontational, one where we use the ample amount of logic and reason that's on our side to try and persuade people about Alaska's interests. And we also need to show them that Alaska has a lot to contribute to the rest of the country.
Okay, well, we're open for telephone calls from anyone who would like to speak with Ethan Berkowitz. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling from Anchorage, please dial 550-8422, and you can also use email talk@APRN.org. So, Ethan, how do you think you're going to do in the bush?
I feel very good about the results I've seen and the conversations I've had. People in rural Alaska suffer right now incredibly from high energy prices, lack of law enforcement, lack of water and sewer. People there know the problems that haven't been solved. And during my travels up and down the Yukon to the hubs, I've had conversations again and again. They just want to do something different. They want somebody who can actually get things done. And perhaps rural Alaska, more than any other part of the state, understands how important it is to solve the problems that we face, because they're absolutely devastating and they threaten the sustainability of villages as well as pose incredible challenges to the families who live there.
No Child Left Behind, I've been made aware, has extracted a particular price in rural education in Alaska, because the education innovations that might cross cultural barriers have had to be pretty much starved in order to meet the mandates of No Child Left Behind. Now, what do you think Congress will do with this, and what direction will you seek to influence Congress on No Child Left Behind?
Well, my feeling is that No Child Left Behind is built on the wrong philosophy. It's built on the philosophy about accountability and standardized testing. We ought to make sure that every student in every community is respected for the unique individual and the unique place that it is. In a country where we pride ourselves on our individuality, we ought to have an educational system that reflects that basic value. That's why I think No Child Left Behind doesn't answer the problem. It also doesn't put people on the right kind of trajectory. It doesn't the focus is too much on the testing and not on the teaching. And as a consequence, we don't impart enough critical skills, critical thinking skills. Don't do enough to make sure that people can walk in other folks' shoes, which I think is really important in a democratic society. And we certainly don't do enough to foster people's imagination and creativity, which Alaskans have in abundance, and we have to do much more for it. And I say this having kids in the schools, family members who are teachers, and having traveled widely. People are not happy with No Child Left Behind. It is a Washington, D.C. mandate. It's unfunded, and it's another example of people far away trying to tell us how to raise our kids.
It would seem to be a massive policy reversal, however, to defederalize education jurisdiction. I mean, the argument, of course, was, well, it's local control, and it should be local control, and we're getting out of local control and federalizing it, even for establishing a federal Department of Education years ago, that there was that argument. And now you have all the mandates out of the federal government. It would seem that it'd be difficult, a stretch, to defederalize education again, wouldn't you think?
You've got to do what makes sense and what's effective. And one of the consequences of the challenging economic times that the country is in is it seems that everything we're doing needs to be revisited and make sure that we're on the right course. We're in a time of incredible turmoil and incredible tumult, and there's a great opportunity in that. And the opportunity is to get the right kind of policies and put the country on the right footing as far as education, as far as infrastructure, as far as all of the underlying issues that we face. The educational challenge that we have is perhaps the greatest challenge that America faces, because if we don't rise to the challenges of the 21st century, we're going to get left behind. And in a lot of ways, what's going on in education is analogous. It's comparable to what's happening everywhere else. If we don't change, we're going to stagnate, and we have to change.
It's Talk of Alaska. Ethan Berkowitz is our guest. And in case you're wondering, many stations will also carry a special we will have on Thursday when Don Young will be available, and also before these microphones in much the same manner, so that you can compare and contrast. But if you send in a question now, as Susie just did for both candidates, I'm sorry, but I can only get Ethan's answer right now.
Well, I'm happy to give Don's answer.
I know what he'd say. Actually, it's a hand gesture. Tuesday's Daily News had a fairly major article on the – this is from Susie out there off the internet. Tuesday's Daily News had a fairly major article on the problem of Medicare payment problems. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it yet, but they're making it more and more difficult for seniors to get health care because many physicians and so forth don't think it's enough money. What would be your position on this?
We've got to do something right away. It's absolutely unacceptable that Alaskans are unable to get medical care, because the approach has to be that when people need medical care, they can get it, and when doctors provide it, they get paid. So what I'd like to see do, at least as an emergency stopgap measure, we have better reimbursement rates for the doctors and the clinics. I'd like to see greater ability and flexibility with the rules that come out of Washington, D.C. I'd like to see some of the approaches that have been talked about, such as Medicare clinics, where doctors can band together, whether in an actual physical setting or in a virtual setting, so that we can help with costs. But we've got to do something aggressively. This is one of the instances where people talk about the problem, but nobody does anything. There's study after study after study. There are plenty of things that can happen, and I just want to make sure that we start doing them, because it's unacceptable to me that people who are in a retirement mode, who are very vulnerable, can't get the doctors.
You're not in Washington yet, but you have watched the Congress approve a bailout of financial services industry. How did you feel about that?
You know, I think we could have done a lot more with a lot less, but doing nothing was not a good option, and so I would have supported it. And you take a step back and look at two of the major assets that Alaska has. One is resource development, and the other is the permanent fund. And the impact of doing nothing on resource development would have been catastrophic. I told Don Young the other day by voting no, he did more to stop resource development than all the environmentalists laid end to end. And what I meant by that is, as long as the credit markets are constricted, as long as people can't go get loans, we're not going to have the ability to do the resource developments that generates the jobs, that sustains the economy. So on the resource development front, it's a critical problem. The other big asset that Alaska has is our permanent fund. And we saw the permanent fund go from about $40 billion to about $30 billion as a casualty of the shocks that happened on Wall Street. And to me, you've got to protect Alaska's assets, our resource development opportunities, our permanent fund. And I am not at all forgetting what's going on with people's retirements. I'm personally putting all those envelopes aside until I have plenty of time to look at them and do it in a seated position.
Well, yeah. Let's go to the phones here and in Palmer, where Mark joins the program with Ethan Berkowitz. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mark.
Yeah, thanks a lot for taking my call, Steve, and thanks, Ethan, for running for this position. My question is, what's your long-term vision and strategy for what I call true energy security for Alaskans and for the day oil and gas have absolutely no value on the world market? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Mark, thanks for your call.
Wow, that's a great question because energy is absolutely critical. And I'm fond of the quote that the Stone Age didn't end because they ran out of rocks. And the age of oil isn't going to end because we ran out of oil. It's going to end because we're going to find something better. I'd like to see a time 25 or 50 years from now where every building is energy self-sufficient, whether it's with heat pumps or solar panels or wind turbines. That's what I'd like to see. And we need to start to engineer ourselves in that direction. But the whole question of energy independence is built on what we're doing with production and what we're doing with consumption. And I want to make sure that we're doing the right kind of production here. I want to continue to see oil come off the north slope of Alaska. I want to see natural gas flow because those are critical components of the country's energy independence and energy security. The natural gas, actually, I think we can get a big boost for developing our gas if we do the right thing on climate change and have the right kind of climate change. But I also want to make sure that in Alaska and across the country, we develop the renewable resources we have. Alaska has 90% of America's tidal potential. We ought to be developing it. There's research and development that comes along with it. It's an industry that can sustain us through the 21st century, and we ought to be on the leading edge. We have wind that would make a huge difference in 80 villages. We could put wind in 80 villages for about $150 million, and the savings, the payback time, is less than 3 years just in diesel costs. There's geothermal energy that's the envy of Iceland, and Iceland is 95% powered by geothermal. Those guys export hothouse bananas to Europe. So we need that kind of strategy in Alaska. It's got to be locally produced energy. But in the lower 48, they also need to do more to produce energy. And we need to do it with the country's hydrocarbons as well as the renewables. And if we do it the right way, it's going to mean lower cost utility bills. It's going to mean job opportunities and business opportunities and a comprehensive approach to climate change. And I think most critically in a world that's as dangerous as the one we live in, it will get America away from a very dangerous dependence on foreign oil and make sure that our foreign policy is based on our values instead.
Well, that gives rise to, I mean, basically, you can't go wrong espousing renewable energy right now, but getting from here to there can be problematical. Let's say that a carbon tax is sponsored in the Congress. Where will you be on it?
Well, you know, it's really, you can call it a carbon tax. There's various different approaches. What you're really trying to do is have a carbon cost capture. The markets aren't working effectively. Right now, people that put carbon in the atmosphere don't pay the price for it. So the polluter doesn't pay. The folks that suffer from the pollution wind up bearing the cost. The market isn't what the economists say. It's not clearing appropriately. And what they would also say is you have to monetize the externalities. You have to make sure that people pay the actual cost. And so there's various approaches that can be taken, a carbon tax, a cap and trade system, which has worked to help stop the problem of acid rain. But we just need to give the markets a chance to work. But if we do it right, they can have huge advantages for Alaska because of our vast size. We have the ability to sequester carbon, the active forestation practices. You know, with all those beetle kills, if we had gone into those forests and made sure that we were making those forests sustainable and greener, we could have helped with carbon sequestration. That's a market for Alaska. But I think if we do it right, and if we can wean ourselves off of our dependence on foreign oil, then Alaska's gas pipeline has greater economic potential. And that's one of the hidden benefits of doing addressing the carbon question. But there's fundamentally, beyond the economics of it, there's a responsibility we have to be good stewards of the earth. And I've got kids, and I want to make sure they have the chance to enjoy the Alaska that I love. And you look around and you see the consequences of climate change. You see the melting ice in the Arctic. You see the permafrost thawing and the release of methane gas. We see the invasive species and ocean acidification. We see these consequences. So we have a responsibility to act.
Well, yes. And, you know, certainly that's what all of our listeners have been saying. But take, for instance, the 150 million, I think you said, in windmills you were talking about, the possibility.
Mm-hmm.
You would think probably the Denali Commission might be helpful in getting and arranging something like that. Do you see any hope of preserving the Denali Commission in the coming years? I mean, already the commission is looking to changing its guidelines on sustainability and so forth. That's going to be quite the fuss at the AFN, I would expect, this week.
Absolutely. And I will fight as hard as I can to make sure that the Denali Commission is operational. We still have analogous commissions in the lower 48, Tennessee Valley Authority, and those things have been going on for 50 and 60 years. We've got to develop infrastructure in rural Alaska. That's part of the responsibility we have. It's part of the statehood compact that we made with the country when we joined the Union 50 years ago. But it's also part of the trust responsibility that the federal government has to the native peoples of Alaska. And so we've got to honor those commitments. We have to make sure that the rural communities in Alaska have safe water, have transportation infrastructure, have the energy infrastructure that they need. But we've got to do it in a way that puts these communities in a place where they can be sustainable, where they are healthy places to be.
Well, we have an internet question by email from Mike, who says, did you ever consider getting some guns and maybe a jacked up pickup and snow machine to improve your appeal? I mean, maybe you're a little too intellectual for Alaska voters.
Well, I don't know how to answer that question. You know, I think Alaska voters are pretty smart, and so I just hope I can talk about them. And you know, I've done my share of snow machining and hunting, and I just sort of take it as part of what you do when you live here. I've had some great adventures out there.
All right.
Some of which I can mention on air and some of which I won't.
Let's go to Remy, joins the program from Homer, Alaska. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Remy.
Thank you. Ethan, I had a question. One of my most pressing concerns with my friends and I is Pebble Mine. I was curious what your stance was on the Pebble Mine.
Well, you know, my stance has been, when I was in the state legislature, I wanted to make sure that you had a strong permitting process. I don't think the idea of having the world's largest earthenworks dam above the world's biggest fisheries makes sense. And so I personally am opposed to that project. We've got to make sure you have a strong process in place, not just for Pebble, but for all the other development. And you have to have the kind of process that works and gives everybody meaningful participation in it. At the same time, let's look at that region of the state, because that region has been hurting for too long. And the poverty there, the lack of opportunity there, is just a crying need for the rest of Alaska to do what we can to encourage development. And there are other mining projects in that region that can go forward that might make sense. I think we should do a lot more to bring down the cost of energies and restore value-added fisheries. So there's a lot that we can and should be doing in that area. And my opposition to having the world's largest earthenwork dam above the most productive fisheries doesn't mean that I'm not sensitive and not aware of the need to have job opportunities and development opportunities in the region.
Well, what about if the company comes back and says, oh, gosh, it looks like we have a lot richer ore than we thought. We might be able to go underground with this and do away with that dam. You think you might change your position?
Look, one of the problems I had, and this is more from a state's perspective, is that I felt Frank Murkowski gutted the permitting process. He got rid of coastal zone management. He moved removed habitat from fishing game to natural resources. He undid the very delicate balance that made sure that people had the opportunity to weigh in a meaningful way. And as I think one of the consequences of that is that people didn't trust the process. At the same time, I'm a little bit leery of doing resource development or resource allocation at the ballot box, and we shouldn't be in a position where that happens. And those are state issues, and those are my personal opinions. I will fight vigorously for the things I believe in. But at the same time, I believe in the rule of law. And if the process is a trustworthy process and it yields a result, whether it's in this front or a different front, you've got to respect the rule of law.
Remy, you still with us?
I sure am.
Okay.
Yep, that pretty much answers my question.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call from Homer there.
Thank you.
Let's go to Valdez and Guy. Guy, welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, it's Steve and Ethan. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party have been basically running this country for how long now? Since
going back to the Whigs.
Yeah, and these parties are the ones that got us in the position that we're in right now with everything. I mean, since 1945. Both these parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, knew that we were importing 60% of our fuel. You guys have just been, both the Democrats and the Republicans are responsible. This Glass-Steagall Act that the economy is in trouble was voted on by both Democrats and Republicans. And you guys have been making more and more problems. The drug problem. This drug war has been going on for 71 years.
All right, let's get it down to a question for Ethan Berkowitz.
Well, I want to know why we don't have more representation from the other parties in this state. You know, these guys have shut it out that we only get these two choices of these two parties, and it's a good old boy network, and I'm tired of it, and I'm going to just listen to what you guys have to say about that.
All right, Guy. Thank you. Ethan, do you feel trapped by the two-party system?
I hate partisan politics, and I learned a lot about it when I served down in Juneau, and I saw what happens when politics is just about which party's going to win the next election rather than putting people in positions of public office where they're ready to lead and ready to govern. So we need to make sure we have changes. I had a bill when I was in the state legislature that would have taken away state recognition of political parties because I think that there's no reason, and we've seen it with the closed primaries, there's no reason why you should have public money to support a private partisan interest. And I just don't like that. I want to make sure that we have the kind of representation in Congress, not just from Alaska, but from around the country, that's about solving problems, not about winning the next election. So I've always stood up for that. People who know me and have seen me in Juneau know that I'm always willing to work hard with people of different persuasions when the opportunity presents itself. But if you put me in a corner and you swing at me, I'm going to swing back. And that's not done because of what the impact on me. It's done because I have a responsibility to protect my constituents and defend my constituency. And I will always do that, regardless of party affiliation.
Well, it does seem that parties sometimes are the tent is a little too big to really have a good place to stand, if you know what I mean.
Well, what happened here is we saw a lot of corruption that happened because there was too much – there was one party rule and one industry, and there was a convergence of the same people were right at that – that convergence, and that's not acceptable. You need to have checks and balances in the system. And generally speaking, we've seen an erosion of the checks and balances that protect individuals against the abuse of power that come from one party control or one branch of government control or one industry control. And if there's any lesson that we should have from what happened in Alaska, what's happening in the country with the economy, it's the importance of checks and balances. It's the importance of separation of power. It's the importance of making sure that we can every individual has a chance to stand up and be heard and protected.
Ethan Berkowitz is our guest on Talk of Alaska from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. Well, Ethan, it occurs to me that in response to our question from Guy, that what will often happen is that the good ideas will sometimes arise on the margins and then get absorbed by the parties as time goes on. If it's a really good idea, somebody will grab it and run with it.
I've found that to be the case. You know, I noticed a lot of times that during the years I served in the minority, there were a lot of good ideas that came from the Democrats in the state legislature that eventually were absorbed by the Republicans and became law. And I guess that's the way the system should work. But we need to step away from party-driven politics and start to make sure that politics is about people, because that's who we're supposed to serve.
Let's go to our next caller, who is Greg, calling from Hoona. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Ethan Berkowitz, Greg. Hello, Greg. Are you there, Greg?
I got to go. Yes, I am. I would like this whole problem with our financial system, and I'd like to ask Ethan what he thinks about it. When we're just repeating history of 1930. The shakers and movers of this country ran out of land to expand the cities. They actually collapsed the monetary system, called it a depression, and there was never a depression. It was manipulation of the money system, and now it's happening again to suck more wealth out of our wallets. And this country had so much money at its disposal, and that's why this country's so great, is we set up a monetary system that took the prime that you pay at the bank and put it back into the United States coffers. And with that prime, they paid health care, they paid for our roads, they paid for the infrastructure that built this great country. And then the bankers of Europe, which our forefathers ran from out of debtor prisons, they saw the money we were making and how successful we were, and they tried and tried and tried to get into our money system, but they couldn't until the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. And they conceived it over the Christmas vacation of that year. And when it reconvened, the Federal Reserve Act, which gave our monetary system to a private banking system, never got ratified by the states. So essentially, we are running on an illegal money system that has been the greatest scam that this country has ever had to endure. And now it is bankrupting this country. And the politicians in Washington haven't got the kahunas to stand up against them and put our monetary system back under the federal government instead of a private banking system.
All right, Greg. Let's see what kind of answer Ethan Berkowitz has for that.
Thank you.
Greg seems to think that the Federal Reserve was a bad idea, and maybe this is the opportunity to do something about it.
Look, I think we need to be willing to look at absolutely everything. When I look at the problem, I see a couple of sources that we need to be very aware of. First is we saw an amazing concentration of wealth that we hadn't seen since the 20s, where the top 1% was getting more than the bottom 80% in terms of what advantages of the economy we're doing. And that makes a top-heavy economy, and that's unstable. The other thing that happened in this country was we used to be a nation that prided ourselves on our savings rate. And that savings was really important for giving us economic strength. It was a buffer against hard economic times. But at this point, America is the world's largest debtor nation, and that's hugely problematic from the structure of the economy. The third thing that's gone on is we'd stopped regulating risk. And it used to be insurance, for example, was a heavily regulated area. But they created these what they called derivatives, and they found ways to go around the regulation. And all of a sudden – people that were supposed to assume the risk didn't, and they just made money on every single transaction. And as a consequence, there were no consequences. That's not an acceptable case to be. People allowed greed. Greed was able to survive without any cost at all, and that's not acceptable. So you get those three structural problems, and you have a big deal. That's why we need to make sure that whatever fix happens works for Americans, doesn't just work for the institutions.
Thank you. Ethan Berkowitz is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. In celebration of Alaska's 50th anniversary of statehood, the Governor's Legacy Dinner will be held on November 14th at the Hotel Captain Cook. All eight of the living governors of Alaska will be in attendance for this elegant and prestigious event. Enjoy world-class entertainment, gourmet dining, and special anniversary gifts. For more information and to make your reservation to the Alaska Governor's Legacy Dinner, log on to alaskaturns50.com. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Statehood Celebration Committee.
It's election season, Talk of Alaska, and we've got two shows this week for many of these APRN member stations. We've got a show today with Ethan Berkowitz and then a show on Thursday between 10 and 11 with Representative Don Young, the incumbent. Ethan Berkowitz, of course, a Democrat, and that leads me to the next question. Comes in over the internet, Ethan, from Annie, who says, are you hopeful, especially with the increased voter registration and excitement about the upcoming election, that the Democratic Party in Alaska will be able to expand its membership permanently? And then beyond that, if so, as a leader of the party, what will you do for working women? So even if you lose the election, I think she's saying.
Well, what I hope happens is that as many people as possible participate in the process. That makes the process better. And I'd like to see us elevate the quality and tone of debate. One of the things that's hard for me to do is listen to how personalized political attacks have been. And I'm proud of the fact that I've worked hard to talk about issues and focus on the vision I have for the state and the values that I think are important. We trivialize politics far too much in the country, and it gets too petty and it doesn't address the issues when it's all about personalities and political parties. So I'm looking forward to the short answer is I'm looking forward to seeing more balance in Alaska, because if we have more balance, we're going to see greater protections against abuses of power. And we're clearly in Alaska suffering from abuse of power. As far as what am I going to do for working women? Well, I'm very dependent upon the largesse of a working woman in my house. My wife works, and I will clearly do what I can to make amends for having subjected her to this campaign. But generally speaking, we need to do more to make sure that pay equity is the order of the day. We need to do more with child care. We need to do more to bust that glass ceiling in a way that's meaningful. So I've been fortunate in my life to be surrounded by a lot of very strong women, and even if I wasn't naturally predisposed to be supportive of women's issues, I couldn't go home unless I stood up for them.
Did you get to see the Democratic caucus in Muldoon?
Yes, I did.
That was something.
Yeah, it was
cold that night.
It was cold that night. I'd never seen a traffic jam like that. I was getting reports from around the state that fire marshals were shutting down other caucuses. And to me, that was incredibly energizing. And I'm happy to have been part of the one from my political party. But I was also happy to see that the Republicans had some massive turnout, too. And that says that people are engaged in the political process. And the danger that's happened, and I watched this. You know, I was in Juneau when all this these scandals broke, is people the public stopped paying attention. The press wasn't given enough scrutiny to what was going on. And as a consequence, the political process stopped being controlled by the people. And I very much believe in a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. But that depends on having the public being involved in the political process.
Yeah, you know, I think I know this is kind of off the subject of your candidacy, but nonetheless, you were there and you watched it, and we watched it too. And it was kind of like we in the media felt we'd done our job by reporting what went on. If people didn't catch on, we didn't feel it was our business to keep repeating it.
Well, someone asked me to when I was on another show with another individual, he asked me to critique the media, and I said, great, you're going to ask me to fight with people who buy ink by the barrel, but which is generally a bad concept. But, you know, we have inconsistency in the media here, and especially the coverage of what went on in Juneau is there's a lot of good reporters – or not a lot. There's a few good reporters. There's a lot of turnover. There's a lot of inability of some of the major newspapers in the state to pursue everything that's going on. And some of that's because we're a small state, and it's very difficult to pay for reporters. But we've got to demand more. The public has got to demand more. That's part of the checks and balances. The press is supposed to be the public's eyes and ears in government and make sure that people aren't misbehaving.
I think a lot of times the public doesn't realize how much power they actually have in this situation. But we recently saw it, for instance, in the Mark and Bob come to mind, and Eddie Burke comes to mind. You know, when people want to get worked up, they really can make a difference. And I think it, also at the newspapers, this happens. They pay more attention than people might realize mm-hmm. to the feedback that's coming in. Often there isn't any. Or if there is, it's in very predictable lines.
The public does have a responsibility to watch what's going on.
Well, okay, back to questions of candidacy here. In Anchorage, Nancy joins the program. Nancy, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Ethan Berkowitz.
Thank you. I wanted to get back to a question of energy. National leaders talk about clean coal as a solution to energy independence, and yet it's something of a misnomer because clean technology still emits greenhouse gases and involves strip mining. So I wonder whether Mr. Berkowitz feels whether this is a misnomer. And second part of the question is, will coal be a source you promote if you do take a seat on the Energy and Commerce Committee?
Good question. We got lots of coal in Alaska.
We do. We have the world's, or at least the country's, biggest coal reserves. And we need to continue doing the research to make sure that we can do coal in a carbon-free sort of way. Clean coal is one of those terms that was created by those who also did things like the Healthy Forest Initiative in order to talk about timber activity. So it's one of those terms that's become part of the political shorthand. And I'd note that both presidential candidates are interested in developing coal, and currently I believe something like 40% of the nation's energy comes from coal. So I would love to see us be able to use coal in a way that's cleaner than we have been doing, and that's going to require a lot of technology and a lot of commitment from the country. And, you know, some of this goes back to what we're going to do as far as energy development goes to altogether. And I kind of like what John Kennedy said when he promised to put a man on the moon within 10 years. And that took a national commitment. We need to have a similar national commitment to produce the right kind of energy for America that gives us energy independence, that protects, that guards against the consequences of climate change. And we can do it. We just haven't worked hard enough at it.
Yeah, I've been reading that GAO report on carbon sequestration from coal plants, and it's very sobering when you get into the technical details of how little has actually been done despite all the talk.
Yeah, the one bill, or one of the few bills that has my name on it from the state legislature, was about carbon sequestration. It's a tricky thing to do when taking carbon from the atmosphere and putting it – it's not just putting it underground. If we grow ponds full of algae, the algae is a form of sequestration. Forests can be ways to sequester carbon. So there are different ways of doing it. But the technology isn't there. The research isn't there. The consequences of injecting carbon underground, maybe to aquifers and to subsurface geology, unclear at this point. but we haven't studied it with enough energy. And this is one of the consequences. We've seen over the last 8 years not enough research and development, not enough science-driven decision-making. And I think that we need to have policies that are based on actual facts that helps us make better decisions.
Yeah, right now, FutureGen has been canceled, and that was the main demonstration for finding a new way to get energy out of coal that would also take the carbon out and sequester it, and it hasn't been funded. Nancy, does that answer your question?
Yes, it's clear that Mr. Berkowitz understands that the technology isn't there and that would inform his decisions on coal. So that's what I was getting at. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go to Roger now in White Mountain. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska, Roger.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen. I have a comment and a question. No Child Left Behind standard is needed throughout the nation so as we can all be on the same page. America lags behind many industrialized nations academically. It would be too expensive, and it's much too late to change horses in the middle of the stream. My question is, what type of national educational system do you have in mind? I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
All right, Roger. I'm sure you've thought about this one, Ethan.
Well, I have, and it's good to hear from White Mountain. I was there about a year or so ago, and I hear the new school is online there, so that's a good thing. Look, we've got a major problem in this country and in this state, and particularly in rural Alaska. In rural Alaska, only 40% of kids who start high school finish it. In the state, it's 60%. Nationwide, it's two-thirds. So there's a huge number of kids that aren't getting the full benefits of an educational system. And I've seen what happens, particularly in the villages. Schools that are in danger of failing, oftentimes what happens is kids who are enrolled there and might be at risk drop out. And that's not performing an educational service to those kids.
Yeah, it's been said they're just voting with their feet.
And we're not training them. We're not preparing them to succeed. And we have to do better. And this is one of the concerns I have with No Child Left Behind. It doesn't respond to the unique conditions of Alaska. Bethel had and has a terrific Yupik immersion program. It wasn't consistent with No Child Left Behind. So instead of accommodating what was going on in Bethel and was providing a really critical part of the educational system and what's necessary for cultural sustainability, people in Bethel had to change what they were doing. And that's not right. We need to make sure that whatever comes out of Washington or Juneau respects the rights of parents and school districts to provide the kind of education that makes the most sense in that school.
But, you know, if you have a district that is just simply bad, incompetent, whatnot, how do you reform it? How do you fix it? It seems that is the whole idea of the leverage of federal jurisdiction was that, okay, we'll have tests. And if the kids pass the test, we set benchmarks, and eventually someone's going to have to take over that school district.
So what happens is you wind up stigmatizing schools and kids who go to the schools and the families whose kids are there. And at the same time, the state's not paying teachers what they should be paid, and it made the whole wage and benefit package worse than it ever was. So you have teacher turnover rates of about 30% every year in rural Alaska. That's not acceptable. We don't do enough with teacher housing in the villages, much less everybody's housing in the villages. So there's a lot of work that can be done, and it's a complex problem. And to say that just by imposing standards, we're going to reform the educational system is not right. The problem I have, and I keep coming back to this, is it's all about the test. And it's all about accountability, which helps the administrators and helps the school, but it doesn't translate to what's in the kids' best interest. And an educational system is designed or should be designed to make sure the kid gets the most from their process and from their education. So we have a long ways to go to making sure that Alaska has a 21st century educational system. My concern with No Child Left Behind is it doesn't focus on the right criteria. It focuses on the test. It doesn't focus on the skills and the character that's necessary to succeed in life.
How about highly qualified teachers? Do you think it's okay on that one?
Look... I can go through – I will go through. We don't do enough in this state with preschool. We're one of 10 or 12 states in the country that doesn't have universally available preschool. That's a huge problem for us. We need to have preschool. We need to do more with vocational and technical training. Because we're a resource development state, it doesn't make sense that we export our resources and import our workforce. I mean, 30% of the people who work on the slope today aren't Alaskans. Those are good jobs. Alaskans should fill them. We need to make sure that in our schools, we have extracurriculars, sports and art and music and all the things that might capture a student imagination and drive to learn. We don't all learn the same way. We are all unique individuals. We ought to have an educational system that reflects it. We also should have an educational system that isn't built the way that recognizes we're in the 21st century, not in the 19th century. We're not any longer designing – we shouldn't design our schools to put kids in 19th century factories.
Ethan Berkowitz is our guest. He's running for Congress on Talk of Alaska from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. Let's go to Jerry. Joins the program from Homer again. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jerry.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, great program. Ethan, I'm really glad to be able to speak with you this morning. My family supports you, and I think you're the only candidate, really, that understands the energy issues and power issues we're going to be facing and how serious they are. You've got a dynamite background. I'd like to talk, though. You know, everyone talks about the economy as being the main driver of this election, but for me, it's the pollution of this world. To me, it's the energy issue, because if we don't solve this, there are enough greedy people in the world. We're going to get our money things back together because people want to make money. But it's this planet that we are going to have a hard time reconstructing. I go back a long way in the energy field. I had a number of companies in the late 70s and 80s that were put out of business when the solar tax credits ended. I call it the Great Purging. The oil companies came in, bought out every major solar and energy company in America and basically destroyed all the research. So the first thing we've got to do is try to recoup so much of that research that was destroyed. I'd like to see the state subsidizing perhaps the University of Alaska to develop that 40-mile electric car. Studies show people drive about 40, 45 miles a day, period. That's the end of it. And if we can get this 40-mile electric car going, which is not a major obstacle, the oil crisis is just about over. I'd also like to see the state subsidizing, taking perhaps some of the money from the permanent fund or some of the money that we have in savings and subsidize alternative energies in the homes. Simply doing it in business, I don't think, is totally appropriate. Because
all right. So where does the U.S. House come into this, Jerry?
Well, I'd like to see, again, tax credits and subsidization of windmills, of solar panels, of especially Pelton wheels. Gosh, our water is wonderful here. People with a small creek near their home don't need to pay an energy bill.
Well, actually, you know, the Pelton wheel, one of the ideas I've always loved is you put one at the bottom of Thompson Pass on the pipeline there, and there's enough energy just from the oil flowing downhill to power Valdez.
Absolutely.
So
and
we
the
get
energy
we
crisis is over.
It's like cutting wood, you know. It warms you twice that way.
I think I sense tremendous agreement here. Let me ask him as a state policy, even though he's running for U.S. House, Jerry.
Sure.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, Ethan, in a short minute or two, how do you feel about putting more money into research on some of these alternative energy issues and the engineering of a possible 40-mile electric car in Alaska?
Well, first of all, it's a state issue, but it's a federal issue, it's a local issue, it's a business issue, and you need to see coordination in order to do this right. I've not only seen electric cars, I've seen electric ATVs. So there's electric four-wheelers out there that can make a lot of sense, because one of the problems with wind turbines is that you don't know what to do with the excess energy. And if you could dump it into your four-wheeler or your Snow-Go, that would make a lot of sense. But I would like to make sure that we do the research and development here. The universities in Alaska and Fairbanks and Anchorage and Southeast and around the state, we ought to be leading the way. And there's great opportunities here. And they're doing a lot of work up at UAF. They're doing some work at UAA, but we're not doing near enough. We ought to be leading the way. This is a great opportunity for us, and if we don't take advantage of it, we're going to get left behind. This is another one of those instances where we have to change or we fall behind.
Are you talking with the Democrats, Democrats in the U.S. House, even now about how you might tackle energy if you get elected?
Well, I'm not presumptuous enough to look past November 4th, I have made it clear that when I've talked to them that the energy issue is absolutely critical. I've done a couple of events with other people, and the energy issue is right at the crux of it. And Alaska is uniquely positioned to help the rest of the country, and I make that case again and again.
Ethan Berkowitz is our guest. He's running for the U.S. Congress against incumbent Don Young as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, the University of Alaska, the home of award-winning faculty, students, and alumni, and offering 500 different degrees and certificates. Find one that's right and do something major. Information at alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. And by
First National Bank Alaska. Branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
It's Talk of Alaska. For most of our APRN member stations, there are two shows this week. One is today with Ethan Berkowitz. The other with his opponent, incumbent Don Young, is on Thursday between 10 and 11. Let's go now to Ketchikan, and Carol joins the program. Carol, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Ethan Berkowitz.
Hello. Are you there?
We are.
Oh, good. Well, I'm enjoying this. I like your style, Ethan. I'm calling about transportation issues because I think that's another step there involved in the energy issue. And I'm wondering what your approach will be to use marine transportation as public and mass transportation, as well as a transportation that doesn't involve road construction, what it involves is harbors and ships and the relationship between Alaska and the lower 48 in connecting the two big population centers of Seattle and Anchorage, and how you intend to approach that issue as part of your energy package.
Shipping and marine highway. Okay.
Well, all of these are great topics. I would love to be able to hold forth and have conversations for an hour on each one of them. I haven't spent a bunch of time down in Southeast. I will tell you that we need a ferry system that is affordable and reliable, because what we've got now, unfortunately, is neither. And one of the things we should be doing, it seems to me, is building more of what I would think of as a mosquito fleet, you know, smaller boats. But this is a kind of policy that has to emerge from the state, because we've got shipyards in Ketchikan and Sitka that should be building boats that serve all the communities, and we shouldn't leave the communities isolated. We shouldn't make it so expensive for families to travel in and out of the hubs. You know, it's at $40 a ticket for a family of four. All of a sudden, you're spending $300 or $280 for a round trip ticket for a family of four to go shopping, and that's too much. We need to do better than we have been doing, and I'd like to see us produce them down the ships in Southeast. But the whole question of transportation is part of the country's energy answer. We've had an energy and a transportation structure that was built – that is based primarily on these outdated formulas of road miles and miles traveled. And we've got to change things where we have a transportation strategy that helps us be more efficient than we have been. And you read the transportation bills, and they're unique. All they say for their mission statement is, we're going to spend transportation money. You read a health bill, and it talks about increasing the quality of life, and there's a mission statement to them. There's no mission statements to the transportation bill. There's no direction, and we need to change how it happens in Washington, D.C., and that is ferries. It's mass transit. It's reversing the trend that's seen people drive alone a lot more today than they did even 20 or 30 years ago. So there's a whole combination of things that have to happen. But mobility is about freedom. And we've got to be free to move people and goods, and it has to be done quickly and affordably.
Okay, let's try lightning round here. Let's go to Scott in Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Ethan Berkowitz, Scott.
Steve, thank you very much for your program. Ethan, thanks for coming on. Tough questions get answered here. This seems minor to some extent with what's been covered so far, but I got a nice glossy flyer from the National Rifle Association the other day, and it makes it sound like Don Young's going to be the only savior between the Obama White House and us losing our guns. And I'm just wondering, you covered something about hunting earlier, but tell us where you stand on those issues, and I'll take my answer on the air.
I'll be very clear. I support the Second Amendment. I think law-abiding citizens should have the right to carry guns, and I believe firmly in the Constitution, and I will protect all of the amendments in it, all of the rights that we have there.
All right, Scott. Yeah, I think it's worthy of note, and Don Young would be proud to say, he is a board member of the National Rifle Association. Let's go to Martha, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Ethan Berkowitz, Martha.
Good morning, Senator. Can you tell us where you stand on matters of race and governance, particularly Native governance?
How many hours would you like?
Well, if you can take a topic like adoptions and the current controversy on that, but where do you see the difference between race and governance, for example, for starters?
Well, I when you talk about Indian Child Welfare, ICWA, it's part and parcel of what's called the federal trust responsibility, which isn't a racial relationship between the federal government and the Native peoples. It's a political relationship. And we've got to – it's a political commitment that was made and has to be honored. It's written in the United States Constitution.
Where do we stand now with the state on that, or where does the state stand now on that?
I haven't seen.
We've had some court rulings that the state has not honored, both on the federal and state level, if I'm not mistaken, that you've talked about before or I read about.
Well, I know that when Tony Knowles was governor, they formed what was called the Millennium Agreement, which was agreements between the state and tribes. And the Murkowski administration retreated from that. And I don't, frankly, know where the Palin administration is.
Yeah. Okay.
As a Democrat, what's your position going to be on BIA funding and Indian Health Service and all that?
This is part of the trust responsibility, and we need.
There's never enough money.
there's never enough money, and some of it, strangely enough, for BIA just disappears. And we've got to have accountability, but I want to make sure that we have the kind of opportunities in rural Alaska that we have everywhere. It's a question of fairness to me. I mean, people who've not been to villages should go to the villages, and there are just incredible people there. And I hear a lot of time from folks in the major cities that we can't sustain rural Alaska, but I think urban Alaska loses tremendously if the villages don't exist. And we need to recognize that it's very difficult to live in the villages. The skills that are required to succeed there are different and they're unique, and I think they should be cherished, and we should do everything we can to make sure we have sustainable communities across this state.
It's a human capital. And it's an investment.
It's about who we are as Alaskans.
Yeah.
And we are more than just Anchorage and Juneau and Fairbanks. We are all the villages, all the people. And we need to recognize that it's a source of incredible strength.
All right, Ethan Berkowitz, thank you so much. Not a single question about fisheries. I can't believe it. This is Alaska.
I'm going to Kodiak this week, so I'm sure I'll get a few there.
I reckon you will. Don Young coming up Thursday. Gooseberry Peter on the controls. Lynn Anderson on the phones. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.